Radio 4 presents the Mark Steele Lecture, a series of lectures on people with a passion. Tonight, Muhammad Ali.
The life of Muhammad Ali proves that if you have no interest in sport, you are objectively, mathematically wrong. Firstly, because unlike other forms of entertainment, the plot with sport isn't mapped out in advance. You know, it's a King Lear, the bloke's going to get his eyes put out. It might be more exciting if sometimes the torturer just put the scalpel wide of Gloucester's cheek, and then a commentator went, "Oh my goodness, and it was easier to score than miss." Because mostly, sport isn't just about sport. It's about the subplots and the drama of everything around it. And the thing with Muhammad Ali, not only was he a symbol of black civil rights and the movement against the Vietnam War, he was someone who changed those events. His influence even reached as far as Downsview Junior School, where I was in 1970, when he was about to fight Joe Frazier for the first time. And we all desperately wanted Ali to win. So why was this? We didn't know anything about black civil rights. And if we had done, we'd have just gone, "Wow, they get to sit at the back of the bus all the time. Can we be Negroes, Mrs. Talbot?" Muhammad Ali was born as Cassius Clay in Louisville, Kentucky, at a time when blacks weren't allowed in the same swimming pools as whites. Kids weren't allowed to the same schools or parks, in the cinemas. They had to sit in the balconies. The Red Cross even kept blood segregated. So there must have been these blokes going, "The way I see it is that you can go around like mixing up and interracializing with the blood, because then you might be making us white folks less intelligent." Clay's father was a billboard sign painter, and when Cassius was 12, he bought his son a bike. But one night the bike was stolen, and Clay ran to a policeman crying that he wanted to whoop whoever had taken it. And with this motivation, he joined a gym and began to learn to box. Now, to get this decision in context, boxing was one of the only places that blacks and whites were allowed to make contact. And even then, it was really only as long as the white man won. Now, we know in this country that we're used to a bit of sporting bias. For example, if any foreign athlete fails a drug test, it's "Ban them for life!" But if they're British, they say,
"I can't understand it. It must be this rare condition I have where my sweat turns naturally into ecstasy."
But this is all relatively harmless compared to the furore in America in 1908 when the black Jack Johnson won the world heavyweight boxing title. Cartoons portrayed Johnson as a gorilla. Ministers preached that congregations should pray to restore white pride. And then as Johnson arrived in the ring, a band struck up a song called "All Coons Look Alike to Me." Now, Clay was aware of this history, and he dedicated himself to boxing partly as the best way to earn respect in his community. Another influence came from the mix of his father being a Baptist and his mother a Methodist, who must have taught him how to talk with conviction. If Clay's parents had been Church of England, he'd have ended up saying,
"And so it came to pass that I became the greatest." Or, to put it another way, "I float rather like a butterfly and sting somewhat akin to the proverbial bee."
Now, Clay learned early on that being a showman was integral to his art. His fights were shown on a local television station, and he'd make predictions such as,
"This guy must be done. I'll stop him in one."
He was entered into the Olympic Games in Rome, where he became a celebrity, not just for winning the gold medal, but also for his poems and his predictions. And Cold War America at the time loved him. So Clay was then put up against Sonny Liston for the world heavyweight title in 1964 in Miami. But things were changing in America beyond boxing. Campaigns for civil rights had spread across America. 250,000 people turned up to hear Martin Luther King's "I Have a Dream" speech. But it wasn't King that had attracted Clay. In 1961, he'd heard Captain Sam Saxon of the Nation of Islam. And he agreed to join as long as the membership could be kept secret. The head of the Nation of Islam was Elijah Muhammad, who claims that the black race is descended from the tribe of Shabazz that once ruled the world. But 6,600 years ago, they said, an evil scientist called Yaqub was exiled to the island of Patmos with 59,999 followers. Bit by bit, he and his descendants bred the lightest people together so that a race of white devils was created, and they then went off to take over the world. But they also say that the reign of these devils will end when a 1.5-mile spaceship appears in the sky before 1,500 planes emerge from the ship to destroy the white race. So, like most religions, hard but fair. But all Also, like most religions, although it sounds a tad irrational, you could argue, it could only make sense because of ideas that were rational. The nation's most prominent spokesman was Malcolm X, and now white people had firebombed his home. His father had been attacked by racists. His mother had swindled out of the insurance when his father died. You could see how he came to believe the story of the evil scientist. In 1961, the Nation of Islam was declared officially un-American. So this might be why, when Clay joined the Nation of Islam, he wanted to keep his membership secret. But when he fought Liston, he was still the American establishment's favourite. And it was Liston who insisted that the fight shouldn't be shown in segregated cinemas. Whereas Clay was seen as a jolly prankster. And he was also developing his style of mocking opponents, saying,
"He's too ugly to be the world champ. To lose your money, bet on Sonny."
Now, this might not seem that special now, because we're used to that sort of thing, like when Tyson went mad at the weigh-in with Lennox Lewis and screamed, "You bitch, you coward, you faggot," while holding his crutch. Though I couldn't help thinking that's got an element of camp about it, hasn't it? If it hadn't all kicked off, his next line would have been, "Oh, Lennox, who did your dreadlocks, love? Was it the council?" No going below the belt. All story of my life. Clay was also popular because he was the underdog. Hardly anyone expected him to win, but Liston resigned after the sixth round and Clay became the champion. The next morning, Clay announced he was a member of the Nation of Islam. Television appearances were cancelled, advertising deals were rescinded, and his record, "I Am the Greatest," was pulled out of the shops by Columbia Records. And the next furor came when Clay changed his name to Muhammad Ali, the name that was given to him by the Nation of Islam. And blacks in America, of course, had been given their names by slave owners who owned their ancestors, so it's not surprising that they would want to get rid of these names. But the establishment refused to call him by his new name, considering that true Americans would stick with the name that they were born with, like John Wayne or Rock Hudson or Jackie Kennedy. But then Ali made a series of statements that weren't very popular in all circles. For example,
"When I was growing up, we were told Santa Claus is white. That's brainwashing. The biggest lie ever told to children. They think everything good has to come from something white."
Now, the only thing he could have said more provocative than that was that Santa was not only black, he was a Rastafarian. "If you take trouble to come down dem chimney and I and dem not leave a rascal mince pie." Malcolm X was moving towards the idea that he should participate with civil rights campaigners rather than ignore them, and that whites could be allies. So he was thrown out of the Nation of Islam and he tried unsuccessfully to get Muhammad Ali to leave with him. Now, Ali's next defence of the world title was against Floyd Patterson, another black boxer, but one who'd promised to
win the title back for America, for the image of a black Muslim as the world heavyweight champion disgraces the sport and the nation.
And Ali replied,
"I's gonna put him flat on his back so that he'll start acting black."
In the fight, Ali kept being in a position to knock Patterson out, but he allowed him to recover so that he could keep punching until after 12 rounds, Patterson was put out of his misery as Ali stood over him, yelling,
"Stand up, white America! Stand up, white America!"
And no matter how much you try and imagine the impact of this, I don't think you really can. Here is a country in which black people can't be served water in Woolworths, and a militant black Muslim is defending his world title on live television by screaming, "Stand up, white America." The whole of society was polarised by this. It'd be like if during an episode of Ground Force, Charlie Dimmock started battering Alan Titchmarsh unconscious with a shovel. Respectable opinion would be horrified, and anyone who was half decent would be going, "Look at this, it's fantastic!" For example, the black activist Eldridge Cleaver said,
"Ideologically, this was a pivotal event. The victory of a new world over an old world."
Ali explained the way that he saw the role.
"We black people could become free sooner than you think if all the athletes and entertainers took a walk through the ghetto and said, 'We're with these people and we ain't gonna sell out anymore.' I get pleasure out of walking down the alleys. The whole neighborhood comes out. They haven't ever seen a celebrity sitting on the garbage can with them."
So Ali's stance helped transform the way that millions of black people thought about themselves, because segregation would affect your self-esteem. It's different from now, when black kids are expected to be confident. It's like, I remember I was stood outside this college once when I was standing in this election, and these two black kids come up, and one said, "Yeah, no, this is good stuff, man, I'm going to vote for you." And his mate said, "You can't vote, man, you're only 17. And he said, "I can get around that, I've got connections, man." It wasn't just America, though, that was polarised around Ali. It was the whole world. He went to Ghana, one of the first African countries to win independence. And a friend he went with said,
"One day we got in the car with no plan, and 5 minutes after we started driving, people started lining the road shouting, 'Ali! Ali!' Thousands of people came out of nowhere, all calling, 'Ali! Ali!'"
So the terrible thing is now, people think that they can achieve the same celebrity status by poncing about for 2 weeks in the jungle. So you know now, celebrities with image problems are going to be desperate to get on the next series. You know Barrymore's going to end up on it. So Ant and Dec will end up screaming, "From our original 8 celebrities, we're down to 3, and we haven't even started voting them off yet." Ali's allegiance to the Nation of Islam was so solid it withstood the night when Malcolm X was assassinated, and on the same night, Ali's house was bombed, possibly as a warning not to defend Malcolm X's memory. Then his status as celebrity and hate figure grew even more. In 1966, America became keen to sign up as much of the country's youth as they could into the army to send them to the war in Vietnam. So Ali was called up, but he said he wouldn't go, as it was against his religion. So journalists besieged him with questions, during which time he made the simplest statement that became a symbol of the decade.
"I ain't got no quarrel with them Viet Cong."
Now, to grasp the impact of this, you've got to imagine what the atmosphere was like at the time. It was long before the big wave of draft dodging that followed. It was easy to see the Vietnam War now as a bit of a dreadful mistake, but that's because there's a fine tradition of liberal people who are highly principled about opposing wars on the one condition that they ended at least 20 years ago. It's wars that are happening now they find difficult to oppose. "Oh, but if he gets the materials, he might have a nuclear bomb by Christmas." The Women's Institute could have a nuclear bomb by Christmas if they got the materials. Maybe we should bomb them and have press conferences where a spokesman says,
"Unfortunately, there was a certain amount of collateral fudge."
And in 1966, the Viet Cong were assumed to be preparing to destroy the Western world, while almost every newspaper said that the war could be won inside a year and the Americans would be making everything in Vietnam cosy. Ali was asked to go to Houston before an army board, either to be inducted into the army or to explain his reasons for refusing. And on the way, as the plane hit some turbulence and some of the passengers panicked, one woman stood in the aisle waving a Bible, shouting,
"God is punishing us because he's on the plane. God wants you off the plane, Cassius Clay. Oh, forgive us, oh Lord."
No one was certain what Ali would do when he was asked to step forward and be inducted into the army, except Ali. He said later,
"The world was watching to see if I'd buck Uncle Sam, and I couldn't wait for the man to call my name."
A spokesman for the U.S. Justice Department had said,
"If he wins, all the Muslims will refuse to take the oath. And then where will we get the soldiers?"
And the stakes went even higher when Ali was reported as saying,
"No Viet Cong ever called me nigger."
So it was the main topic of discussion from then on amongst black soldiers. The establishment was all the more angry with Ali because when he was asked where Vietnam was, he said,
"On television."
So he was convicted and sentenced to 5 years in jail and stripped of his boxing title. But he could stay outside jail while waiting for his appeal. So he used that time to carry on making more stroppy speeches.
"Everything good is supposed to be white. Angels are white. With blonde hair and blue eyes. Where are the colored angels? They must be in the kitchen preparing milk and honey. We look at Miss World, we see white. Even Tarzan, the king of the jungle in black Africa, he's white."
He's right, isn't he, about Tarzan? That must have been infuriating. Imagine how white people would feel if the heroes of popular English culture were black. If Pride and Prejudice, when perchance, Miss Bennet, if I may be so bold as to ask if you may visit the Darcy Massive to greet one so fair and delicate, indeed, if you may permit, enchanting as yourself is a rare pleasure. In other words, you is fit. Ali went on an enormous speaking tour, making speeches such as,
"Why should they ask me to put on a uniform and drop bullets and bombs on brown people in Vietnam while so-called Negro people are treated like dogs? I have lost nothing, but gained the respect of thousands worldwide. I've gained peace of mind."
And he attended his first anti-war demonstration outside a dinner that President Johnson was at. Ali arrived at the demonstration in a Rolls Royce, and he made a speech from the top of a dustbin. Imagine that. It'd be like going to see your kid in a nativity play, and then Robert De Niro's in the cast.
"I'm sorry, but the inn is full, but we do have a stable."
"Full? You're telling me it's full?"
By 1968, though, there was a mass anti-war campaign, and the Black Panther movement was armed and organised now across America, and one of the most popular songs was James Brown's Say It Loud, I'm Black and I'm Proud. During the Olympics in Mexico, black American athletes stood on the medals podium giving the Black Power salute. The winner of the heavyweight boxing medal, however, posed for the cameras, draped in an American flag, and his name was George Foreman. It's easy to be so caught up in Ali's spirit here that you forget that he did actually preach the Nation of Islam doctrine. For example, in one interview he said,
"A black man should be killed if he's messing with a white woman. And if a Muslim woman wants to go out with white men, you kill her too."
Which, at the risk of being controversial, I'm not sure I go along with. But one of the remarkable things about Ali was he had the wit to make his Nation of Islam ideas seem plausible. Personally, to be honest, it doesn't really upset me when religions are a bit fiery. They should be fiery. If there's a God, it wouldn't be content with a church that holds a village fete and the odd jumble sale. That's why I don't agree with these people who say that thought for the day slots should be non-religious. It isn't religious enough. At the moment, it's just like a panel game where the contestant has to crowbar God into that day's news.
As the controversy over A-level testing continues to rumble, isn't this a bit like Jesus? For though he never had to sit A-levels, he certainly had to do tests. When he was sent into the wilderness, wasn't that God's way of saying, "You may turn over your papers and begin now"? And also, lots of teachers have beards, like Jesus.
So they should let truly passionate believers do thought for the day, like the military wing of Hamas. Well, once again, the half-term holidays are coming up, and like many parents, you may be wondering what on earth to do with your bored 12-year-olds as they mope around the house. So one tip you may consider, why not strap them to a bar of gelignite and send them into a crowded marketplace? Ali's court case creaked along until 1971, but by then hundreds of thousands were dodging the draft, and the Supreme Court eventually reversed Ali's conviction. He'd had his boxing licence renewed, and a fight was arranged with the current world title holder, Joe Frazier. On television, he recited a poem predicting the fight.
"Ali swings with the right. What a beautiful swing. And the punch raises the bear clear out of the ring. Now Frazier disappears from view. The crowd is getting frantic, but our radar stations have picked him up somewhere over the Atlantic."
Now, this poem proved that Ali was a genuine natural comic, because it was the same poem he'd used 7 years earlier before fighting Sonny Liston. So he knew that the real art of comedy is knowing how to recycle material. But he would dominate interviews with 10-minute speeches, which was obviously connected to his religion and his politics. You couldn't advocate the Nation of Islam with the eloquence of a normal sportsman.
Well, you know, obviously we're hoping for a good result against the White Devils, and and we, well, we miss Exe, obviously, but no one player is bigger than the team, and, you know, we're just going to take them one devil at a time.
He was asked whether he would ever stand for president, and he said,
"I should stand for vice president. That way you know the president would never get shot."
Ali knew how to exploit his political reputation by portraying Frazier as another hope of the white establishment. Now, it was true that the establishment wanted Ali to lose, but that hardly made Frazier the figure that Ali made him out to be. And Ali called him an Uncle Tom and a gorilla, which wound up Joe a little bit, as it did when Ali said,
"Joe Frazier is too ugly and too dumb to be champ. And ask him how do you feel, champ, and he'll say, duh, duh, duh."
Surely he could have done better than that. He might as well have got one of them paper things young kids have in playgrounds and gone,
"F-R-A-Z-I-E-R, you smell."
The fight was the biggest fight ever in terms of media interest, worldwide television audience, money. Dustin Hoffman and Diana Ross tried to blag their way into the front row but were told it was reserved for the press. Then Frank Sinatra had to sit there pretending to be a photographer. And although Frazier wasn't the figure that Ali made him out to be, some people were aware of why they were so desperate for Ali to win. One American journalist wrote,
"One guy was a symbol of black pride, the other was like your parents were. He just did his job. And one was against the war, the other had no feelings on it."
But for the first time ever, Ali lost. All over the world, radicals were devastated, as was Beckett Class in the fourth year of Downsview Junior School. And for the next 3 years, Ali kept fighting. He lost another fight to Ken Norton, who broke his jaw. And the new world champion by this time was George Foreman, who'd knocked out Joe Frazier. And then a black businessman, Don King, arranged a deal worth $10 million with the dictator of Zaire, Mobutu, to stage a fight between Ali and Foreman to boost his country's profile. Now, there was outrage that a country should try and promote its business through boxing. But then when Tyson came to Britain, despite being a convicted rapist, Jack Straw said...
To not admit him would hurt small businesses in Manchester.
It's as if there were loads of hardware store managers going, oh, no, we're hoping Tyson were going to pop in and buy a spirit level. The bulk of the population of Zaire seemed aware of what Ali represented, although Ali said...
Oh, you boys who don't take me seriously, when you get to Africa, Mobutu's people are going to put you in a pot, cook you and eat you.
So 2 days later, the Zaire foreign minister rang Ali at home and said...
We are not cannibals. We don't eat people.
Prince Philip must have thought, how does he get away with it so easily? But once in Zaire, Ali's past made him a hero, whereas Foreman made himself instantly unpopular by arriving with his pet German shepherd Alsatian, as this was the same sort of dog used by the Belgian police when the country had been a colony. On the other hand, according to one journalist...
Ali would go on walks into areas where they didn't have electricity, and everyone knew him. He was having a ball.
And as he toured the villages, he began a chant of Ali Bumaye, which meant Ali kill him. Now, think of George Foreman for a minute here. Imagine being in a country where the entire population is shouting, Ali, kill him. You could wander into some remote village with one well and a chicken, and they'd go, oh, look, it's the bloke we want Ali to kill. Now, Foreman had been knocking his opponents out in 2 rounds or less, and that's what almost everybody expected would happen to Ali. Almost his entire backup team was convinced he was about to be humiliated. And in the first round of the fight, Ali just sat on the rope and he just let Foreman, possibly the hardest puncher in history, keep punching him. And this, I have to say, is the one aspect of Ali's boxing technique that I think I mastered. Now, I'd taken the day off school on the day that the fight was on the television at the night time so that I could watch it without knowing the result. And from round two onwards, I remember Ali just following this same strategy of standing on the ropes and getting punched and leaving almost every spectator puzzled and assuming that any moment he'd be knocked over. But every time Foreman punched him, Ali was whispering.
Is that all you got, George, huh? Is that all you got?
And with each round, Foreman got more tired, until by the 6th round it was Foreman's longest fight, and then in the 8th he was exhausted, and then Ali came off the rope, suddenly swung a series of punches and Foreman toppled over. And as he fell, the orthodox boxing technique would have been to land one final punch to make sure, but instead Ali let Foreman tumble because, as Norman Mailer said...
He didn't want to spoil the aesthetic of the moment.
It was the most poignant, staggeringly, socially charged sporting moment of the last 60 years. And that one action lay the triumph of intellect, of wit, charm, flamboyance and rebellion over brute force. And I'd have been even more staggered if, just before the fight started, my mum hadn't said, it's a good job Ali won. Oh, sorry, dear. As Ali began his second stint as world champion, the entourage around him grew bigger than ever, and most of this crew were blatantly robbing him. It may be that Ali's belief that there was a natural solidarity between all black people blinded him to the fact that he was surrounded by black people who were ripping him off. Not that he was against commercialism. For one fight, when the tickets weren't selling as well as he hoped, he proposed a fake kidnapping to boost publicity. Maybe this is why the Hezbollah took Terry Waite.
Tickets are going great at Canterbury Cathedral, Terry. Next Christmas, you'll walk into Cinderella with Leslie Joseph.
Following the Foreman fights, Ali fought Frazier again in the thriller in Manila, in which Frazier retired with one round to go. But then, later on, instead of retiring, he was persuaded to fight twice more, partly because his money had been given away to charity projects, to the Nation of Islam, or to his entourage, and he lost both of these final fights. By the 1980s, one of the ways American society prevented more radical change was by incorporating a layer of blacks into the establishment. So then they tried to remodel Ali as safe and cuddly. This process began when Jimmy Carter suggested using Ali as an envoy to meet the Iranian government when they were holding the American hostages. It says something about Ali's prestige that the hostages were impressed with this. If these were British hostages, which sporting hero would we send? Gazza. Which
Which one's the Ayatollah, eh? I brought a tea towel for your heed, eh? Eh, look, I've got this little pen here with a lady's costume and you tip it up and it all falls off. You can see her tits and everything. What about that? You can keep this and use it for your squiggly reading.
Then Ali was sent to Africa to argue for the American boycott of the Olympics in Russia, but he was too honest to do the job. When a Tanzanian asked him at a press conference why Africans should support an American boycott when Americans hadn't supported the African boycott against apartheid, Ali replied,
"You're making me look at things different. Maybe I'm being used. If I find out I'm wrong, I'm going to cancel this whole trip."
Wouldn't that be brilliant if just once a politician did something like that? If Prescott said,
"Really? We sold Saddam weapons? Well, no bugger told me. That's dreadful."
Ali met a series of world leaders, including President Sadat and King Faisal of Saudi Arabia, and he probably believed he was influencing them rather than being used by them for their own prestige. Even more strangely, he allowed his name to be used in support of Ronald Reagan and George Bush's election campaigns. But then in 1990, against their advice, he went to meet Saddam in a gesture to try and prevent the Gulf War. It's a shame, really, that his two careers couldn't be reversed. So from time to time, he'd sit down with Joe Frazier or George Foreman for a political discussion, and then meet Reagan, Bush and Saddam and smash their heads in. But it was for other reasons that he remained possibly the most popular person on the planet. He was made an honorary citizen of Sri Lanka. He attracted a crowd of 25,000 in Kuala Lumpur, and he was voted Sports Personality of the Century in several countries, including India, not known for its love of militant Muslims. And now, barely able to walk or to talk, he seems to have made his peace with the American establishment, and the establishment of the entire world seems to love him, which makes you wonder, who was it then who ever opposed him? But this is what happens. All the world loves a rebel as long as their rebellion was 30 years ago. Like in Britain, where the establishment agreed that it was terrible how the Jews were treated in the 1920s or how blacks were treated in the 1960s. But they do exactly the same to today's immigrants. And when Labour took over, all Jack Straw had to do to look liberal was be better than Michael Howard. What an easy gig he must have felt like, whatever doctor took over from Harold Shipman. The cliche is that boxing is the way out of the ghetto. But whereas boxers like Tyson are a celebration of how somebody might individually climb out of the ghetto, the purpose of Ali was to try and raise everybody collectively out of the ghetto. That's why he is the only person who's ever been able to say, "I am the greatest," and appear humble. And why his humanity and his mischief could speak to the natural rebellious Bart Simpson instinct in any class of 10-year-olds, whether in Louisville or Downsview Juniors. And that's also why, somewhere in this world, there must still be someone in hiding now going, "I know he's 60, I know he's shaky, but I'm still not coming out. I'll tell you what, nicking that bike was the worst thing I ever did."
The Mark Steele Lecture was written and performed by Mark Steele with the help of Femi Alufo-Wadjo Jr., Martin Hyder and Debbie Isaac. The producer was Lucy Armitage. Fight the power! Fight the power!